From the sprawling urban media campus of the North Carolina Reading Service, it's John Fetterson again. Today in Studio 37A, I'm reading the Indie Week of November the 3rd, 2022. And this new panoramic surrounding gives me a wide view of today's musicians. And they are over from our sprawling in-house music annex. Earnest young performers working toward a prestigious degree in radio theme music. Well done. And when we close the program today, I'll personally be punching their participation cards, helping them on their way, hopefully, to a lucrative careers. Now, the central articles from today's online and print editions are concerned with the election upcoming. But before I read that, I'll get to the online IndieWeek.com and report from, originally published online in North Carolina Policy Watch by Lynn Bonner. Out-of-state patients spur abortion increase in North Carolina. Many more people are seeking abortions in North Carolina since June, when the U.S. Supreme Court rescinded the constitutional right to abortion, and neighboring states began outlawing or severely restricting them. 53% of the people coming to a Woman's Choice North Carolina clinics are from out of state, said spokeswoman Amber Gavin in an interview. At least one person has come as far away as Missouri. Getting to North Carolina from out of state is a complicated balancing act for patients, Gavin said. That depends on whether they're flying in or driving, whether they can get an appointment, and where the physicians they need to see are located. She said, we are really seeing folks from all over the South. North Carolina is one of the states that has experienced the biggest increase in abortions since April, according to a report released last week by We Count, a group led by the Society of Family Planning. The We Count report takes a state-by-state look at abortion access since the Supreme Court decision. North Carolina, which borders or is relatively close to states that outlawed or severely restricted abortion, saw a 37% increase in August compared with April. At 36% and 33%, Kansas and Colorado had similar percentage increases. Nationwide, abortions declined by about 6% between April and August. Planned Parenthood in North Carolina has also seen a substantial jump in out-of-state patients since June. Some of the impact is described in a motion Planned Parenthood South Atlantic filed this month related to a 2020 lawsuit challenging North Carolina abortion laws. Abortion is legal in North Carolina but requires a 72-hour waiting period, bans telehealth for people who take abortion pills, and prevents certified nurse midwives, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners from providing abortions, among other restrictions. Planned Parenthood health centers in the state have seen an overall increase in out-of-state patients since June, according to the court documents, with some of the biggest jumps at its clinics closest to the state border. Planned Parenthood in Asheville is the closest clinic for hundreds of miles for people from several states. At that clinic, 74% of the patients were from out of state in August, compared to 37% in August of last year. In Charlotte, 52% of patients in August were from out of state, compared to 14% a year ago. Molly Rivera said, abortion is time-sensitive. Days and weeks matter. She's the communications director at Planned Parenthood South Atlantic. In 2020, 5,300 of the 30,000 abortions performed in North Carolina, about 18%, were for non-state residents. Only some North Carolina metro regions have abortion clinics, so even some state residents must travel more than 100 miles to get to one. Clinics are located in the Triangle, Charlotte, Asheville, Wilmington, Winston-Salem, Greensboro, and Fayetteville. In its latest motion, Planned Parenthood South Atlantic asked the court to allow advanced practice clinicians to provide pills for medication abortions to help reduce patient waiting periods. Those same medical practitioners are already allowed to prescribe the same medication for miscarriage management. Waiting periods for medication abortions have gotten longer since 2020, despite Planned Parenthood's efforts to increase availability. The waiting period for medication abortion appointments was 12 days in the summer of 2021. That's increased to 2 to 3 weeks since July 1. Nationally, about 3/4 of abortion patients in 2014 had low or very low incomes, according to the Guttmacher Institute. That's an organization that supports abortion rights. Most had at least one child. Nonprofit abortion funds help people pay for the cost of the medical procedure, travel, childcare, and lodging, but those funds are stressed by high demand, higher costs, and in some cases, fear of prosecution. The Yellow Hammer Fund, an abortion fund in Alabama, stopped offering help to people seeking abortions when that state's law banning abortion went into effect in June. The Alabama law includes an aiding and abetting clause that forced the organization to stop helping people travel to other states. Kelsey McLean, the fund deputy director, said the way we used to operate is no longer legal after the erosion of Roe v. Wade and the Dobbs decision. Telephone calls to the organization reduced to a trickle after the Dobbs decision, she said. People are fearful to say the word abortion. The Dobbs decision really did terrify people into thinking abortion is no longer an option for them. McLean suspects that more people in Alabama will self-manage abortions by obtaining pills by mail. Aid Access, an online telemedicine service, delivers pills. The Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund is still working to help people obtain abortions in other states, said Lori Bertram Roberts. Costs have multiplied as people travel to North Carolina, New York, California, Washington, D.C., and even to Mexico to obtain abortions. She said our funding budget is $15,000 a month. $15,000, $20,000, that's not even remotely enough. People want to go where they have some connection, like family or friends, she said. But factors like travel time and appointment availability also help determine destinations. Despite the pressures, Roberts was preparing to announce that the Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund would begin helping people from Alabama to help fill the void. She said, "We're still here on the ground, still funding abortion." The Mississippi Fund is also helping people who were forced to stay pregnant with prenatal classes, doulas, and baby supplies. We know of several already, she said. North Carolina's position as a state where abortion services remain available is precarious. The Republican-controlled legislature passed abortion restrictions in recent years that have not been able to withstand Democrat Governor Roy Cooper's vetoes. Republicans need to pick up only a handful of seats in the state House and Senate to be able to regain veto-proof majorities that could render Cooper's vetoes irrelevant. Next, also from IndyWeek.com online by Tomasi McDonald. This week, the leaders of a voter rights advocacy group announced that an organization founded by Stephen Miller, a former advisor with the Trump administration and Duke University graduate, has targeted Asian American voters across North Carolina with, quote, hateful, racist mailers aimed at suppressing their vote and subduing the political power of the fastest growing racial demographic in the state. In a Tuesday press release, said Chavi Kana Koneru, the executive director of North Carolina Asian Americans Together, NCAAT, and NCAAT in Action, stated, quote, the racist and misleading mailers were sent by the Washington, D.C.-based American First Legal Foundation, AFLF, the conservative organization founded by Trump confidant Stephen Miller. As the architect behind the Trump administration's notorious Cages for Kids policy, that separated hundreds of children from their parents at the southwest border. The release stated, Miller has a long history of peddling racist hate and division against the vulnerable and underrepresented. NCAT officials sent samples of the noxious mailers sent to voters here in North Carolina, as well as Arizona, Virginia, California, Michigan, Nevada, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, and Texas. One of the inflammatory mailers says Biden and the left want to decide who gets hired and who gets fired according to their skin color. Even pilots will be chosen based on skin color, not flying ability. A second mailer insists, quote, Biden and left-wing radicals are engaged in widespread racial discrimination against whites and Asian Americans, even though it's against the law. Now hiring, reads a third racist piece of drivel, followed by, quote, requirements that include a college degree, quote, may be black or Latinx, but white and Asian Americans need not apply. The mailer's note, recipients can learn more at aflegal.org. According to that AFLF website, Miller is president of the nonprofit, which claims that it is, quote, fighting back against lawless executive actions, and asserts the nation's principles are now under attack like never before by a coordinated campaign from the radical left's anti-jobs, anti-freedom, anti-faith, anti-borders, anti-police, and anti-American crusade. Miller and AFLF officials were not immediately available for comment on Wednesday. Cornero in the press release notes that while anti-Asian sentiment emerged as a prominent feature across the political landscape in 2020, quote, this blatant piece of disinformation is the first time Asian Americans in North Carolina have been the target of suppression efforts around an election. Konaru said Miller's AFLF and the agency's attempt to suppress voter turnout is partly in response to U.S. Census results that show exponential growth in the nation's Asian American population. Adding, here in the battleground state of North Carolina, the Asian American voting bloc can determine the outcome of toss-up races statewide. The release also noted that digital and radio ads have also popped up across the country, purposefully targeting multiple underrepresented groups, including Latinx, transgender, and Asian communities. The tactic, Conero observed, repurposes an old tactic historically used to drive a wedge between Asians and other racial communities of color in the United States. Konaru thinks the toxic mailers are evidence the country's bad political actors fear Asian Americans' growing political power. Stating in the release, Asian Americans had record turnout in 2020, 72%, and so far Asian American early vote turnout is on track to exceed that compared to the 2018 midterms. Explaining Konaru, right-wing racist actors are exploiting the fact that Asian Americans have received limited voter contact by political parties by using manipulative ads to keep them from voting. The director pointed to a recent poll jointly conducted by the nonprofit advocacy group and the U.S. Immigration Policy Center at University of California, San Diego, which found well over 160,000 Asian American voters in North Carolina, 61%, have never been contacted by any political party about this year's election. Cornero said these false ads could undermine the faith Asian American voters have in candidates this year and beyond. The racist and misleading mailers may have the opposite effect and prompt more Asian Americans to cast ballots during this month's midterms. According to NCAT's poll, 50% of Asian Americans are more motivated to vote in this year's election compared to previous ones. Allison Chan, a longtime Durham voter who received this postcard, said if Miller's targeting our communities to discourage us from voting in the midterm this year, it's not going to work. Meanwhile, Cornero says NCAT will continue to call out and discredit disinformation that seeks to mislead and harm the Asian American and Pacific Island community. Quote, Asian Americans have stood resilient against attempts to suppress and silence us, and our community will come together to make our voices heard at the polls. Finally, this article says concerns or questions about voting can be addressed by calling NCAAT's Election Protection Hotline, which serves voters in over 20 different Asian languages. And this hotline's phone number, 919-591-2442. All right, our print edition now from IndyWeek. It starts with Jasmine Gallup's article, High Court, High Stakes. In less than a week, North Carolina voters will decide the future of abortion rights, election maps, and even education spending. Will these issues be decided in the race for U.S. Congress? No. In votes for state senators? No. In fact, many major policy decisions in the next few years will be made by candidates historically overlooked by voters, the justices of the North Carolina Supreme Court. With a divided government, namely the Republican-controlled General Assembly versus Democratic Governor Roy Cooper, disputes often come before the state Supreme Court to mediate. Billy Koraher, a political analyst and writer, says, Our legislature has gotten more extreme, and it necessitated the court stepping up and protecting rights under the state constitution. You see a similar dynamic at the federal level. How often do Congress and the president actually get together and pass an important bill? It's pretty rare, and that's left the U.S. Supreme Court as the source of change when it comes to our policies. On the North Carolina Supreme Court, Democrats currently hold a narrow 4-3 majority, which has resulted in a host of decisions preserving voting rights, striking down abortion bans, and mandating better education funding. But if Republicans flip just one seat on the court this November, they will retake the majority and are expected to uphold abortion restrictions, gerrymandered maps, and other GOP-passed measures. Bobby Richardson, chair of the State Democratic Party, says, quote, We need a court system that is going to rule by the state constitution and provide fair decisions based on the law rather than based on their own political affiliations. Our Supreme Court has been the backstop for political gerrymandering and barriers Republicans have tried to put in the way of African Americans having access to the polls. She adds, if we lose the majority, we will lose the power of voting rights, and perhaps even other rights. We will not have any backstop for women's right to choose their own medical care. Over the next few years, the North Carolina Supreme Court could certainly weigh in on abortion rights. When the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June, it left it up to states to make decisions on when and how abortions can take place. North Carolina's 20-week abortion ban has already been upheld by a federal court, but Republicans have promised to pass more stringent restrictions if they can override Cooper's veto. And now, they no longer have to consider the protections of Roe. If those laws were challenged, they would move to the court, where the state's Supreme Court would be the ultimate authority, says Tara Romano, executive director of Pro-Choice NC. She says, we don't know what kind of laws the General Assembly might come up with, but there could be protections in the state constitution around privacy, non-discrimination, so some of those laws could land in front of the Supreme Court. For a long time, the courts have been a backstop against legislative and executive branch overreach. We still need to have that sort of fair and balanced makeup on the court. North Carolina is one of the few southern states where abortion is still legal, albeit with lots of restrictions. Romano says she's worried about Republicans potentially passing laws they've seen enacted in other states since Roe was overturned. Quote, We're seeing anti-abortion lawmakers say they want to pass laws that say you can't share any information about abortion or that people can't travel out of state to access it. Those are the types of laws that could end up before state Supreme Courts. Not just being unable to access it, but not being able to travel or being able to share information. Another big issue is voting rights, which encompasses issues like voter ID and gerrymandering. Since 2010, North Carolina legislators have been embroiled in what seems like an endless parade of legislation around election maps. Most recently, the state Supreme Court threw out a set of Republican-drawn maps, arguing they were unconstitutional because of partisan gerrymandering. The case was decided by the slim 4-3 Democratic majority. Now, that case has been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which will decide whether the North Carolina legislature has absolute authority over redistricting, or if state courts can weigh in. The court's ruling in the case, Moore versus Harper, will determine whether new maps are drawn solely by the legislature or if they'll continue to end up before the state court with national implications. Regardless, issues of gerrymandering and voting rights could continue to be disputed in the North Carolina judicial system. The court is also set to hear challenges to North Carolina's controversial 2018 voter ID law, which could disenfranchise black voters. In addition, it will soon consider whether thousands of people on parole or probation should have their voting rights restored. Bree Breaux, an advocate with All on the Line, a national anti-gerrymandering organization, said, "I think if you look at the recent decisions from the Supreme Court, they largely upheld individual and civil rights. In the recent redistricting case, the Supreme Court found we have a right to vote in free elections, and extreme partisan gerrymandering is a violation of that. These issues are likely to come up again. People should be aware of that when they're voting. Look at the judges and see who you feel is going to uphold voting rights and civil rights." Although judicial candidates mostly stay away from hot-button political issues, instead touting their qualifications and independence, the races for the North Carolina Supreme Court are clearly partisan. Millions of dollars have already poured in from political organizations and PACs fighting to get conservative judges elected. The North Carolina GOP and others is supporting Trey Allen, a Republican challenger to Democratic incumbent Justice Sam Ervin IV, as well as Republican Richard Dietz, who's running against Democrat Lucy Inman for an open seat. Corriher says the amount of money pouring into these races is increasing with every election. This year, the issues of abortion and redistricting have drawn national political organizations into the election. In Washington, D.C., a conservative super PAC called Fair Courts America pledged to spend a record-breaking $22 million on high court races in key states, including North Carolina, according to Corriher. The Republican State Leadership Committee also planned to spend more than $5 million, a record amount for that group, on Supreme Court races in North Carolina, Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio. Spokesman Andrew Romeo said the group's focus is on redistricting. On the Democratic side, Planned Parenthood pledged to spend $1 million to support Ervin and Inman, noting the court could soon weigh in on abortion rights, Corriher says. The ACLU of North Carolina also pledged $1.1 million toward, quote, a campaign to educate voters on the importance of the Supreme Court elections this November, using grassroots outreach, direct mail, and digital ads. Chantel Stevens, executive director of the ACLU of North Carolina, said, "There is no doubt that politicians in the legislature will attempt to ban abortion in North Carolina, and we need a state Supreme Court that will protect our freedoms and our state constitution." The National Democratic Redistricting Committee has also spent more than $2 million on races across the country, including in North Carolina, according to FEC reports. Inside North Carolina, one GOP campaign donor launched Stop Liberal Judges, a political committee that has $850,000 on hand, according to state finance reports. Former U.S. Congressman Mark Walker, a Republican, also created Win the Courts, a political committee campaigning on behalf of Allen, Dietz, and North Carolina's other conservative judicial candidates. The group spent about $1,500 through October 6th. Finance reports for the weeks leading up to Election Day are not yet available. Corriher says these groups and others could potentially drop millions of dollars on ads in the final days of the election. Quote, some of those groups don't even start spending money till the final week of the election. Most of the attack ads you see in these elections are coming from independent groups, not from the candidates themselves. While liberals are giving directly to candidates, Irvin and Inman have each reported raising about more than $1 million, about twice as much as Republican opponents, conservatives seem more focused on campaigning independently for their picks, according to Corriher. Quote, I'm seeing ads pop up on my TV all the time, mostly backing the Republican candidates. It seems like the Democrats are focused a lot more on candidate fundraising. The Republicans aren't as focused on raising money for the campaigns as they are in bringing these independent spending groups to back them up. We also have seen some progressive groups spending money in this election in a way they haven't before, Planned Parenthood and the ACLU. I don't know how that's going to impact the race. For next, Lena Geller's column, End of the Line, will continue a report on the courts and the elections about the Court of Appeals. If North Carolina's U.S. Senate race, a neck-and-neck contest that could see the election of the state's first black senator or the ascendance of a gunslinging, abortion rights denying MAGA-aligned congressman, has stirred so little buzz compared to other contests that national news outlets have labeled it a sleeper race. The four races for the North Carolina Court of Appeals are straight up comatose. The eight candidates vying for state appellate seats haven't aired many ads, nor have they received much attention from the press. As in most years, media coverage surrounding the elections has amounted to little beyond candidate questionnaires, with contenders offering nearly identical responses about their judicial philosophies and camouflaging any significant differences in legalese. And while it's always hard to get voters excited about judicial elections, this year's midterm, which will likely be decided by the public's stance on hot-button issues like abortion, gun safety, and economic policy, have elicited a particularly low amount of enthusiasm for appellate candidates, who usually do not disclose where they stand on such matters, and who, compared to the contenders for the state's highest court, seem to be running for less consequential positions. But while the North Carolina Supreme Court races are certainly momentous, I just read that story, the state's oft-look appellate elections also carry weight. The Court of Appeals, which determines whether trial courts have correctly applied the law, is perhaps best known for pushing cases down the line. And its error-correcting role is an important one. In 2020, for instance, after hearing a case that had been appealed from a Wake County District Court, state appellate judges ruled 2-1 to allow people in same-sex relationships to obtain emergency restraining orders against abusive partners, a protection that the district court had denied, and effectively passed the case off to the state Supreme Court, which voted to uphold the appellate decision. But most of the time, the appellate court, which hears about 60 cases every 2 weeks, is actually the end of the line. Donald Beskin, the trial lawyer and Duke University law professor, says a very high percentage of cases that are appealed from lower courts end in the Court of Appeals, meaning that the Court of Appeals makes the final decision. Many important matters never reach the state Supreme Court. When appellate judges who serve in rotating panels of three rule unanimously, it almost always brings an end to the case. Beskin continues, except in rare situations where the state Supreme Court wants input. In the past year, appellate judges have had the final say on cases ranging from education to rezoning and environmental justice, issuing decisions that have allowed students to sue the University of North Carolina system over fees they paid for on-campus services that were closed during the pandemic, preventing the city of Charlotte from using a rezoning dispute as a precedent in future court proceedings, and granted state legislators the authority to make it nearly impossible for people to sue hog farms for nuisance. These decisions may sound boring, but important ones often do. So while the biggest, buzziest cases of the next few years, like involving redistricting and abortion, will undoubtedly be heard by the state Supreme Court, hundreds of others involving climate action, workplace rights, and public health, among other issues, will be decided by appellate judges and appellate judges alone, which is to say the makeup of the appellate court matters. In 2020, Republicans swept all eight statewide judicial races in North Carolina, winning or retaining three seats on the Supreme Court and five on the Court of Appeals. If they perform similarly this year, they could win two additional seats on the appellate court, which is currently composed of 10 Republicans and 5 Democrats. If the Dems sweep the appellate races, the court will shift to a near-even split. Of course, electing judicial candidates on a partisan basis is contradictory to the impartial positions they are running for. Beskin says, a case should be decided on the law and facts and not on people's ideological views. The cornerstone, the protective bumper, the place we have to rely on if things are going badly, is the court. Since the state legislature switched all judicial elections from nonpartisan to partisan in 2018, Beskin has noticed a shift in the neutrality of judicial candidates. Quote, partisan elections have brought out more people who have very strong ideological views as candidates. And so when I look at the candidates in this particular election, there are a few of them that I think have pretty clear and pretty strong ideological views, which in my opinion is a very bad thing. Beskin does not name names, but he could be referencing Donna Stroud, a Republican incumbent who proudly identifies as the, quote, first conservative to serve as chief judge of the Court of Appeals, or John Tyson, another Republican incumbent whose website says he maintains a conservative judicial philosophy that protects self-defense and parental and rights of the unborn, and among other individual freedoms touted by the GOP. In questionnaires submitted to the Indy and the Fayetteville Observer, all four Republican appellate candidates describe themselves as textualists, a mode of interpretation that focuses on the plain meaning of a legal text, with no consideration of the context in which it was written. Beskin says textualism is a code for "we're not going to legislate," and there's something good to be said about that. But textualism doesn't solve all the problems. A problem may arise after a law is written, and the problem itself could not have been contemplated by the drafters of the text. How does a legislature in 1920 envision, you know, computers? Oftentimes, Beskin adds, a case reaches the appellate court because there's a controversy about what the text means. So it's crucial that judges have the ability to be open-minded in their interpretations. He says, when I'm arguing a case in front of the Court of Appeals, I want a fair shot. Following that as just a list of some of the Court of Appeals candidates running in the Indy Week, and I'll just give a little thumbnail of each of them. Seat number 8, Julie Tate Flood is a Republican facing off against Democrat Carolyn Jennings Thompson. This is a race to fill Lucy Inman's seat, who's currently running for state Supreme Court. Seat 9, the incumbent Chief Justice, Republican Donna Stroud, worked as an attorney and served as a district judge. Her opponent, Democrat Brad Salmon, a district judge, who previously worked as attorney. Seat number 10, Republican incumbent John Tyson faces Democrat Gail Murray Adams. And at seat 11, Republican Michael Stading is up against Democratic incumbent Darren Jackson. Now, Jasmine Gallup with another column. Swing seats. This is about Wake County generally. In southern Wake County, it's easy to see the rural roots of North Carolina. Wide expanses of trees and fields are dotted with simple one-story homes, churches, and schools. Cruising down Fayetteville Road, I see a lot of pickup trucks, along with a Trump 2024 flag. North Carolina's House District 37, which includes Fuquay Varina and parts of Holly Springs, and extends north to Lake Wheeler, is one of four swing districts in Wake County this year. These are districts where the number of people expected to vote for a Republican is almost equal to the number expected to vote for a Democrat. The close divide between the two parties will likely result in some close races, where the winner is determined by only a few thousand votes. This could have significant impacts on the balance of power in the state legislature. Republicans are aiming to secure a supermajority in the General Assembly this year so they can override Democratic Governor Roy Cooper's veto. In order to attain a supermajority, the GOP needs to pick up two seats in the Senate and three in the House, as well as hold on to the seats they already have. And with issues ranging from access to abortion to public school funding hanging in the balance, these are seats Democrats cannot afford to lose. In Wake County, House Districts 35 and 37 are two of about 18 races in the state that are genuinely competitive, according to Princeton's Gerrymandering Project. Wake County's two Senate swing districts, 17 and 18, are even more important, given there are only about eight competitive Senate districts statewide. Mac McCorkle, a professor at Duke University's School of Public Policy. The problem for Democrats in North Carolina is the way Democratic coalition is so heavily concentrated within the cities and with the black vote in college towns. These places in Wake County, like Wake Forest, these are swing districts where Democrats need to win, and if Republicans are making inroads, that's a real problem for Democrats. House District 35, which includes Wake Forest and parts of northern Wake County, has become slightly more competitive this year, thanks to the 2020 redistricting, says McCorkle. Democrat Terrence Everett, the incumbent, is facing a challenge from Republican Fred Von Kannen. Of course, we're also keeping a close eye on House District 37, where Republican incumbent Erin Paré is defending her seat against Democratic challenger Christine Kelly. Paré won her seat in 2020 from Democrat Sidney Batch, who is now running in State Senate District 17, with the help of unexpectedly high turnout from Republican voters. The district, home to mostly white, middle-class families, farmers, and veterans, is the most conservative in Wake County. It's also the only swing district in Wake to lean toward the GOP, with Republicans making up about 52% of the vote share, according to that Princeton Gerrymandering Project. Wake County's three other swing districts all lean Democratic. McCorkle says, if Everett loses, it's going to be a very bad night for Democrats, and Republicans probably would have gained a supermajority. On the other hand, if Kelly wins in District 37, it's going to be a surprisingly good night for Democrats. As an incumbent, Paré will likely have an edge in the coming election, according to McCorkle. She may also have an advantage with Joe Biden as president, since midterms are historically unkind to the party that holds the White House. A Democratic win in District 37 will likely depend on turnout, which could be driven by the issue of abortion rights. McCorkle cites the Kansas effect, where Democratic voters turned out in record numbers to shoot down an abortion ban. Although the vote was expected to be close in that historically red state, Democrats secured existing access in a landslide 59-41 vote. Unaffiliated voters could also influence the election. Earlier this year, for the first time in history, the number of unaffiliated voters in North Carolina overtook the number of registered Democrats and Republicans. Wake County had one of the largest increases in unaffiliated, going from 160,000 in 2010 to 320,000 in 2022, a jump of more than 100%. Unaffiliated voters aren't necessarily the same thing as independent or undecided voters, says Asher Hildebrandt, associate professor at Duke University's School of Public Policy. Quote, there are a lot of voters who, for whatever reason, want to be unaffiliated, want to think of themselves as independent, but still very reliably vote for one party or the other. That said, independents or unaffiliated voters are statistically more likely to split their tickets and be willing to vote for members of either party. Where most voters are likely to vote straight Democrat or Republican all the way down the ticket, independent voters are more likely to cross party lines if they know something particularly good or bad about a candidate, says McCorkle. Polarization is high, but so is the number of independent voters. Quote, when I see turnout projections as high as they are, that scrambles my confidence that the polling can really pick up all that's going on. I don't know whether history is a good predictor. The game's got to be played out. In District 37, the issues voters care about are the ones people are debating statewide: the economy, education, abortion. The higher price of gas and groceries brought on by inflation is on the minds of a lot of voters, according to Hildebrandt. The fact that Democrat Biden is the president as the economy worsens has put Democrats in an unenviable position. Perry and other Republicans are attacking their opponents on the issue, saying Democrats support raising taxes and increasing spending. Kelly, Perry's opponent, says Republicans are, quote, intentionally misdirecting voters with a long-used claim that Democrats will irresponsibly spend and tax at the expense of working families. It's false. If elected, Kelly promises to raise taxes on corporate special interests and the ultra-wealthy, who have enjoyed years of tax breaks thanks to Republicans. The economy is especially important to David Smith, a Republican who cast his vote in Fuquay-Varina on Friday. He says, I'd say I'm more a fiscal conservative, neutral on social stuff. The economy is one of my main concerns, the reckless spending. His wife, Sharon, is also worried about how money is being spent. She's a retired teacher, and she's concerned that the school board is wasting money, she says. Quote, the teacher pay is there, but I think there's a lot of waste. Administrators don't ask teachers what should be in a school building before they build it. And she said, I've opened Mills Park Middle School before. It was brand new. We had a list 10 pages long just from career and technical education of things that should have been done. She's also worried about how the board will spend the COVID relief funds it received after the pandemic. Quote, a lot of that money they got from COVID, they have to spend it by a certain time, so there's limits on what they can even do. You don't have time to make a long-term game plan. On education, Sharon's main worry is the learning loss students suffered during the pandemic. A recent report from the State Department of Public Instruction shows students are behind in almost every subject, especially math and science. It's a practical concern everyone acknowledges, though Democrats and Republicans disagree on what to do about it. One of the linchpins of Kelly's campaign is her promise to support fully funding public education through the Leandro Plan. Kelly talks about closing not only the learning gap, but also gaps in social and emotional support. Quote, we need a nurse in every school. We need access to health services, and the ratio of 1 to 2,500 students is just not feasible. We know that emotionally kids are trying to figure out how to catch up with the isolation of COVID. We know the mortality rate for suicide is now higher than car accidents. It's a huge problem. Paré, on the other hand, has embraced a very different strategy. Her comments on education focus mainly on inflammatory campaign issues like critical race theory and age-inappropriate classroom materials that include LGBTQ themes and characters. Paré is a devout supporter of the right-wing parental rights movement, which has made discussions of race in classrooms taboo and attempted to remove inclusive books from library shelves. Unfortunately, this fear-based rhetoric is connecting with some voters. Douglas Hall, 67, says one of the things that brought him out to vote is the gender issue in schools, suggesting teachers may be influencing young children to identify as transgender. Quote, the idea that we have books that are available in the libraries at young level schools that discuss sex, children just don't need that. That's up to the parents to teach. Then to make such an issue out of what their gender should or shouldn't be at a young age, when they're confused to begin with, they're more apt to think, oh, well, maybe I'm this or that. And they're just not ready to make those decisions at that age. Hall is also worried about increases in crime, which Republicans have blamed on Democrats' support of the defund the police movement. One tactic Republicans are using is a tried and true focus on crime and immigration. Hildebrand says, thinly veiled racist tactics helps scare voters and motivate the Republican base. There's a reason that they're tried and true, because they've used them in the past and they've been effective in the past. On gun safety, Kelly and Pereira once again at an opposite sides of the spectrum, where Kelly, supported by Moms Demand Action, has worked to ban the open carry of guns in public parks and government buildings. Pereira has voted at least once to repeal the requirement to obtain a permit for pistols. Ultimately, even though Hall is frustrated with the political divide and partisanship, he's voting a straight Republican ticket, quote, to make sure there's all the strength possible to oust this Cooper administration, he says. Likewise, Democrats are expected to turn out in strong numbers to prevent the Republicans from gaining a supermajority. Their number one worry? Diane Luparello, 74, the abortion situation. If you don't have a vagina, you should not tell somebody what to do with theirs. Luparella was in her 40s when abortion was legalized through Roe v. Wade. When she heard about the Supreme Court decision to overturn that right, my stomach sank, she says. Although it's still legal in North Carolina, Republicans have been clear about their intent to change that if they win a supermajority. Perret, like many of her Republican colleagues, is a supporter of an almost total abortion ban. In response to a question from the News and Observer, Perret says abortion should be banned starting at some point during the first trimester. Kelly, on the other hand, says she will defend abortion rights, describing it as part of a comprehensive health care plan. Kelly has been endorsed by Pro-Choice North Carolina and Vote Pro-Choice, something Perret has characterized as a negative. Luparello's feelings are clear, however. In my opinion, she says, the Supreme Court was a giant step backwards. I went to high school with a girl who died from a botched backstreet abortion. If abortion had been legal at that time, she would still be alive. All right, for the last policy and governmental article from Indy Week today, Bond on the Ballot from Durham, Thomas E. McDonald. In 2019, Durham voters overwhelmingly approved a $95 million affordable housing bond that was touted as the largest in the state's history. During this election cycle, Durham County residents will consider $550.25 million in education-related bond referenda that will, among other things, build new schools, expand its community college campus, and modernize the Museum of Life and Science. The Durham County Board of Commissioners first approved resolutions in support of this referenda in July. Brenda Howerton, chair of the county's board, Durham is growing and we must support education, she told Indy this week. Wendy Jacobs, the county's co-chair, told Indy that the education bond is the first approved by the board since 2016, when the elected leaders put forth a $170 million bond for Durham Public Schools, DPS, including $91 million for the construction of a new Northern High School and existing school needs, along with improvements for Durham Technical Community College, the Durham Museum of Life and Science, and the county library system. Jacobs says, that bond was approved by the voters. It's important for us to have safe, healthy, up-to-date schools for our children. the lion's share of funding for the current bond referenda that voters will consider on November 8th. That's $423 million, has been earmarked for remodeling DPS's existing buildings and plant facilities, new schools, and land acquisition. Jacobs says the funding will pay for the Murray Massenburg Elementary School and a new Jordan High School. Bettina Umstead, chair of the Durham County Board of Ed, echoed the county commissioners. The proposed funding from the bond will provide educational resources that are needed to keep up the county's growing population. Quote, Durham County is certainly growing. You can drive down the street and see there are new housing developments. There are new businesses coming in. And so we know with all that new housing development comes new families with children. And we want to make sure with Durham Public Schools that we have space to welcome them with open arms. Meanwhile, $112.7 million of the community college funding will support the construction of an 86,000-square-foot allied health building to house simulation and classroom labs, quote, to meet local requirements for nurses, medical assistants, nursing assistants, pharmacy technicians, and other health professions, according to a pamphlet that reached residents' mailboxes late this week. The community college portion of the bond referenda also calls for the construction of a 36,000-square-foot life science training facility and classroom building, along with the additional land acquisition to address future expansion, according to the mailer. For Durham Tech, community college officials point to, quote, major growth in the life sciences sector, with 45 new companies and 7,000 new jobs announced in the last 5 years, with 50% of the activity in Durham. On the community college website, officials note that the school is the only one in the state in close proximity to two care-level hospitals, that's UNC and Duke Health, along with the Durham Veterans Administration and long-term facilities. The school wants to respond to labor demand by making available a trained workforce in a regional health industry that's projected for double-digit growth in the years ahead, according to the community college website. Quote, with booming career opportunities in these sectors, Durham Tech is well positioned to prepare local residents for great jobs and provide a diverse workforce pipeline to area companies. Durham Tech President Jade B. Buxton said, if we want Durham County residents to move into those jobs, we need the facilities and equipment they can train on to be prepared to move in. These are good jobs with good wages and good career opportunities, he added. Another bond referendum would also allocate almost $14 million to one of the city's crown jewels, the Durham Museum of Life and Science, which first opens its doors in 1946. The relatively modest chunk of funding will modernize the facility's learning spaces, where generations of school-aged youngsters received their first meaningful exposure to science, from dinosaurs and weather to the random sounds of percussion instruments or chemistry sets from the gift shop. In addition to significant sustainability upgrades, the proposed funding will support new exhibits at the museum that are focused on climate change, technological innovations, and health science, along with improvements to the museum's indoor and outdoor learning spaces, as well as renovations to its meeting room. Museum officials note that the North Durham facility is a nonprofit that receives little funding and support from the state's coffers. Kari Heinonen, the museum's chief executive officer and president, in a press release, credited the community's support over the decades as being critical to the facility's growth and expansion. Quote, we want our museum to continue inspiring the next generation of scientists, engineers, entrepreneurs, innovators, and leaders right here in Durham. Indeed, the less than $14 million price tag to improve one of the city's educational mainstays that's devoted to science sounds like a bargain. In a political atmosphere where climate change has been derided as a hoax and scientific inquiry has been diminished, Kate Senner, The museum's vice president for development stated in a press release, voters will have the chance to help Durham make a major commitment to education for all generations. And at the same time, they can help create a greener, more sustainable museum that will offer a more welcoming experience to all visitors. The museum, Heinonen noted in September, has been an educational and cultural resource for 75 years. She said, "We are an informal educational institution. We see ourselves working in parallel and partnership with Durham Public Schools." While speaking of the museum's role in the city's educational ecosystem, Heinonen encapsulated the vision, driving all three elements of this bond referenda. "We think of ourselves as building that pipeline of curious learners and curious workers who are going to be filling the pipeline for workers that we need to feed the industry that we are building here in North Carolina. So that's how we see ourselves, as part of that continuum in that community." All right, the clock on our wall, digital, of course, tells me I cannot read three music-related columns to you, which I'm sorry for. I've had to miss this week's Spotlight One. The trio, Chatham County Line, has a new venture into acting. And next is a local music production collective, The Genius Party. And that focuses on the North Carolina and the local hip-hop scene. And there then are two reviewed new releases reviewed in this issue of Indie Week. Dream Root has released an album called Leaf, and the DJ Tree City has a debut titled Good Job. So just a reminder that those of you who want to read these articles that for yourselves and to see more of them in detail, just head over to indieweek.com. And this issue is available free of charge. And speaking of good job, now I, John Federson, will commend our today's young music students with a well-received good job for their spirited execution of our Indie Week theme music. Those 14 minor errors won't prevent me from punching your participation cards. Just bring them on in right after we sign off our Indie Week broadcast today. So, thank you very much, listeners. We'll be back next week with a whole new edition. And, as a matter of fact, it's right after the election. So that'll change the content of the publication considerably, I'm sure. Thanks for listening, John Federson, for the NC Reading Service. So long.